Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Alan Lightman is a physicist and a humanities professor at MIT. He's spent his career swimming in that murky zone between science and spirituality. It's that space that we all stumble through, that contradiction between the material and the immaterial. And in his new book, we join Lightman on his own journey for truth and meaning. It all begins one night in Maine.
My story concerns a particular summer night in the wee hours when I had just rounded the south end of the island and was carefully motoring toward my dock. No one was out on the water but me. It was a moonless night and quiet. The only sound I could hear was the soft churning of the engine of my boat. Far from the distracting lights of the mainland, the sky vibrated with stars. Taking a chance, I turned off my running lights, and it got even darker. Then I turned off my engine. I lay down on the boat and looked up. A very dark night sky seen from the ocean is a mystical experience. After a few minutes, my world had dissolved into that star-littered sky. The boat disappeared, my body disappeared, and I found myself falling into infinity. A feeling came over me I'd not experienced before. I felt an overwhelming connection to the stars as if I were part of them. And the vast expanse of time, extending from the far distant past long before I was born, and then into the far distant future long after I will die, seem compressed to a dot. I felt connected not only to the stars, but to all of nature and to the entire cosmos. I felt a merging with something far larger than myself, a grand and eternal unity, a hint of something absolute. After a time, I sat up and started the engine again. I had no idea how long I'd been lying there looking up.
Alan Lightman, physicist and professor of humanities at MIT, reading from his new book, Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. Professor Lightman, after that moment, what happened after that?
Well, I began getting more of an understanding of the allure of the spiritual world. I suddenly understood in a deeper way than I had before the longing for the permanent, the absolute, the indestructible, the eternal. And that, of course, contrasted strongly with my experience as a scientist.
Right.
And my whole life has been in science. And the scientist views the world in different terms, in material terms. Mm-hmm. Everything in the material world is impermanent.
Everything's in constant flux. Right?
Everything is in constant flux. But at this moment in the boat, I felt like I was connected to something that was permanent.
Can I, if you don't mind, can I share my own story of a similar experience?
Yes, please do.
So I also come from a very scientific family, and my educational background is in science and engineering too. But one day, when my elder child was less than a year old, I was walking home from work here from the studios. And in fact, if we went out on the street, I could show you the exact location where I had this particular experience. And I was thinking about her and just sort of the how amazing it is that this like little collection of, you know, my randomly assorted DNA from me got transferred to her, mixed up with her dad's, to create this being. And, you know, I get the medicine and the biology behind it. But there was something about how I was thinking about that at that moment, that it was dusk and the light was falling out of the sky. And It was exactly how you describe in the book when you were gazing at the stars. I felt almost like a tingling in my fingers, as if I were touching some sort of conduit towards immortality, right? Like I could see through my daughter and through whatever future she has, even beyond her, I could see my own path, my own existence traveling that direction. And it was a physical feeling almost. I mean, as you described, like everything being compressed down to a dot, and that dot was within me. Mm-hmm. And it was stunning. I will never forget it for as long as I live. I think it got me closer to a point where I said, okay, well, maybe this is the thing that people describe as when they see God, or they feel like they have a deeper connection with those very absolutes. I don't necessarily believe in those absolutes, but I can see why searching for them and experiencing them is central to the human existence.
Yes. Well, we could call that the transcendent experience. And I think that the transcendent experience is the best evidence we have for something you might call a spiritual world. And you don't have to believe in God to have transcendent experiences and to feel this connection. I think that there's really a dualism in human beings, that on the one hand, we have our science and we want to have logical explanations for things that we see around us. Of course, that material world has led to antibiotics and smartphones, and we've benefited enormously from that view of things. And yet, we also are aware of our own impending deaths.
Right.
And I think that knowledge of our mortality is one of the driving forces behind our desire for something that's permanent, something that is eternal, something that doesn't pass away, something that's absolute.
This journey that you take in the book to explore that tension between the absolutes versus the flux and the relatives and the ever-changing nature of what we can know. How does science reckon with our need for absolutes? Basically, it says that there are none, right?
Well, I think that many scientists have what I would call an enlightened view, which is the realization that science does not describe all of experience. When I'm flying in an airplane, I'm very happy that the laws of aerodynamics are applying all of the time and not some of the time. So we really depend upon the reliability and the consistency of the physical world. But there are many scientists who acknowledge the existence of a spiritual world or a realm of experience that's not, that's in a different domain than science.
Now, is it that it's in a different domain than science, or simply that science hasn't been able to explain that domain yet?
Well, of course, we don't know the answer to that question because we don't know yet what science can explain that it hasn't yet explained. But we really don't know how far science is going to be able to go. Most religious traditions which believe in God believe that God lies outside of the physical universe, outside of time and space. And if that's true, there's no way that science can prove or disprove the existence of God,
right,
by definition.
But you know, I mean, when I hear that, sometimes I think to myself, well, when some theoretical physicists, for example, or cosmologists talk about multiverses,
yeah,
right, or in the other direction, the quivering of strings being the defining feature of the universe, I'm not quite sure what the difference is between those things and this idea of a God that exists outside of time,
yes,
and space.
Well, I'll tell you what I think the difference is. It's a very good question, because those things, the multiverse and strings, also may be things that we can never prove. The difference is, I believe, in my view, the possibility of multiverses comes out of other theories of physics that apply to this universe and that have been confirmed. It's like seeing a door that's cracked, and there's a dark room beyond it, and the door is open just a little bit, and you see the tail of an animal,
yeah,
coming out. You don't see the rest of the animal, but you've seen other animals like that animal, and you recognize the tail. And it's a very plausible to imagine that there's the full animal behind the door, even though you can't see it.
Right. So it's the difference between what is unknown versus asserting that something is fundamentally unknowable.
Yes, I think that's right. And, of course, the curtain keeps falling away from the unknown in science, whereas I think that neither theology nor science can ever prove or disprove the existence of God.
You know, it's interesting because this basic tension between science and spirituality, as you were saying a little earlier, there are many great minds who try to encourage us towards thinking that there should be no tension there at all, right? I mean, Carl Sagan once wrote that the notion that science and spirituality are somehow mutually exclusive does a disservice to both. And you quote Marilynne Robinson, the astonishing Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, and she says that we acknowledge that the physical brain is capable of such lofty and astonishing things that their expression has been given the names mind and soul and spirit. But nevertheless, I mean, your book here, triggered by that experience on that island in Maine, you say that you go on this journey to explore that gray area between the absolutes and the relative. So where did that journey take you?
Journeys like that are full of contradictions and wandering paths. They're not straight line paths, and you don't really come to any conclusion. But one of the ways that I can express where the journey took me is in thinking about my own death.
Mm-hmm.
Some people believe that there's a soul that will last forever in some form. I don't believe that. I think that we're all atoms and molecules. We're a special arrangement of atoms and molecules that allow for consciousness, which is just a name that we give to the sensation of all of those electrical and chemical exchanges between neurons. That sensation we call consciousness. And I believe that when we die, that special arrangement of atoms and molecules will disassemble. And that's, in a way, an upsetting thought. But I derive some comfort in knowing that my atoms and molecules are still going to be somewhere, mm-hmm. even though they will not know that they were part of me. If you labeled each one with my Social Security number, you could follow all of them as they dissolved in the earth, were incorporated in plants and trees, dissolved in the ocean, and then came out again. And some of those atoms and molecules 1,000 years from now are going to be parts of other people. That gives me a little bit of consolation. To me, that is the expression of my spirituality.
Yeah. That sounds like a scientific framework for reincarnation.
Yes, but without the awareness, they were part of me.
Is there something, though, about the information carried in those atoms that were once you, that are unique to you and your experience, that is
that persists?
Any of that information that persists?
No, I don't believe so, okay. Because the information is not in individual atoms.
Yeah.
It's in the arrangements of atoms. I'm a materialist, and I also consider myself to be a spiritual person, so you might call me a spiritual materialist.
Now, a part of your time when you were thinking about death, as we're talking about, you actually were in a Buddhist monastery in Cambodia?
Yes.
Can you tell me more about that?
I befriended many people there, but one is a Buddhist monk named Yo Hoot. I think people who are familiar with Buddhism know that they believe in something they call the Four Noble Truths, which all deal with suffering. But Buddhists also believe in certain things merely because they were uttered by the Buddha. One of those beliefs is that the universe has gone through an infinite number of cycles and will continue to go through cycles infinitely.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked Yo Hoot, how did he know that? And he said, because the Buddha said it in one of his sermons. Another word for the Buddha is the Lakavidu in Pali, which means the knower of worlds. And I wonder to myself, how do we know that the Buddha was the knower of worlds? Were Einstein and Darwin also knowers of worlds?
Why not?
Where does that authority come from?
And I think we grant that authority. Right?
Yeah, that shows a big difference between science and religion and where authority comes from. If you build a pendulum and measure its swing and find a relationship between the time to make a swing and the length of the pendulum, you believe it not because you read it in a textbook or because Galileo said it. You believe it because you just did an experiment and found that to be the case. Science is constantly revising itself because it's constantly learning new things. And there's no ultimate or absolute authority in science.
And yet, you know, you make the point in the book, though, that there are a lot of very prominent scientists, or I should say there are some very prominent scientists who go to great lengths to use the tools of science to try and disprove the existence of a God. And you say that they're missing the point entirely.
I think they're missing the point entirely. This group of scientists has been called the neo-atheists, and the most prominent of them is Richard Dawkins.
Well, I mean, just to remind folks, you are a physicist. And so if you, when you say that Richard Dawkins is missing the point, then what is the point that he's missing?
He's missing the point that God, as commonly understood, exists outside of the physical universe. Okay. And therefore, you can't use an argument based upon things in the physical universe to disprove the existence of God. That's the point that he's missing. Okay.
I'd add to that. I'd say that the other part of the point that they're missing is that people don't want God to be explained fully. That I think that, and I'm not a person of conventional faith, so I'm not speaking for them. But my sense is that part of the comfort in the absolutes is their fundamental unknowability.
Yes,
and that it's one thing that we are granted relief from.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, and to say, like, there are a set of rules or consciousnesses or intelligences or however, there's a divine presence out there that we will never fully understand, but I guess in many or slash most traditions has our best interests in mind. Like, that provides a great sense of comfort and relief. And so to be confronted with a group of people who say, well, we want to explain why it doesn't exist and we can't explain it. It's like completely different languages entirely.
Yes, I agree totally with you.
But, you know, so, I mean, this gets me to actually something that you point out in the book about the central doctrine of science, and that too is something that must be accepted as a matter of faith.
Yes.
So for people who don't know, when we say the central doctrine, what do we mean?
The central doctrine of science, basically, that the universe, the physical universe, is lawful, that all the phenomena of the physical universe obey laws, and that those laws are true always and everywhere in the universe. We have to accept that on faith because we can't be certain that there wouldn't be some phenomena that we observe tomorrow that is completely unexplainable by science. And so, in that sense, science and religion have a certain commonality.
You know, I feel like thematically a couple of different times in the book, you return to something, you grapple with something that's been a question that I've had about my own existence for a long time, and that is that, you know, I mean, fundamentally, we are all just human beings, that no matter how spectacularly complex our brains are, and, you know, and no matter what the truth or perception of the emergent property of our consciousnesses are, we're still just very meek and inadequate machines to really understand the vastness of everything. And to me, that is one of the reasons why religion and faith and the concept of the divine will forever be an irresistible force in humanity, because it is a way out of our own meekness.
Well, there'll always be a lot that we don't know.
And so many people have, despite being, you know, firm agnostics or firm atheists, they still are drawn back to this. I mean, you write in the book about Van Gogh, right? And his Starry Night, and that even though he rejects religion, he wrote to his brother once, is that right?
Yes.
About how he had to paint the stars because he was seeking religion.
Mm-hmm. Van Gogh hated formal religion, but he painted the sky. It's nighttime, and it has this quiet village below. And then up in the sky, the vastness of the cosmos. And there's such a contrast between what's going on up there and the quiet human civilization below that's sleeping. I think that he felt that struggle.
Brings us back to your moment on the boat, right?
Yeah.
Looking up at the stars in Maine. So ultimately, you know, you talk about absolute versus relative. You talk about your view of what happens at death, whether or not consciousness is just something that emerges from all the electrical activity mm-hmm. through the trillions of cells in our brains. Mm-hmm. But you go out of your way repeatedly to say, all of these things may ultimately be explicable, but that doesn't reduce the experience of them.
That's right. And you could take an MRI machine and you could hook up every one of my 100 billion neurons and when I was lying in the boat looking up at the stars, and you could measure the electrical output of every neuron, and it still would not explain what I felt.
Mm-hmm. I know exactly what you mean. And that's why, to me, it's fundamentally a beautiful thing. That feeling and that experience is, to me, that is how I understand the divine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Alan Lightman, physicist and humanities professor at MIT, the new book is Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. It's a absolutely lovely read, and it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much for coming in.
Thank you, Magna. It's been a pleasure to be here.
And Professor Lightman will be speaking tonight at the Harvard Bookstore. We've got lots more information about that at radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.